Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Welcome to Bristol's first podcast, Dialect, which goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. on BCFM, Bristol Community FM, that is. This week, for the first time, the full interview with one of the original legendary Free Festival guitarists, Hawkwind's Hugh Lloyd Langton, who died last week. An interview I recorded last year, May in fact, last year. Plus we've got our weekly disabled update from Jason Yannakopoulos. More too in our weekly series with Peruvian-born US filmmaker and legend Alan Frankovich, who died in mysterious circumstances in Houston Airport Customs Hall in 1994. Alongside the feature films of the Greek-born French filmmaker Costa Gavras, Frankovich's 1970s and 80s documentaries give us a deep insight into a criminal side of the Western intelligence services, such as, well, they call themselves services, such as MI6, the CIA, the Israeli Mossad, and NATO intelligence in Brussels. Blowing people up, then blaming it on someone else. Black operations under the secret orders of prime ministers, presidents and royalty. And we have the weekly What's On Guide and Song of the Week from Jeff Sparks. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number is 01454 318753, and we'll have a reminder of both the phone numbers for Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show. We start this week with Jason Yannakopoulos. Hi, Jason, and welcome to Dialect again. Now, this week, what have we got on what are we going to discuss?
Well, I'm quite aware that the Picture Fence has been looking pretty bleak for disabled people recently. So, as this is the Christmas era, and in Christmas spirit, I'm going to spread a message of hope.
Oh, that's so good, because I mean, the thing is, with all these ATOS assessments, where basically, you have to appeal those assessments if you're going to get a fair judgment. This is really, actually, really, really upsetting for a lot of disabled people. So essentially, we've got the bankers sort of strutting around the city with their massive million-pound bonuses. Yep. And amazingly enough, not being arrested for libel scandals and things like that.
Wow.
And yet disabled people are being expected to pick up the tab for all this. There's a lot of bullying, psychological pressure on the disabled people at the moment. So anyway, how can you manage to construe a message of hope out of all of that, Jason? I think you're doing quite well.
Well, it's difficult, admittedly. But one has to remember just how far the disabled movement's come along, as I covered doing the history of the disabled rights movement a few weeks ago. Things comparatively are a lot better now, and of course there's a lot to be done. But even in previous days, even in older days, you can look at some really historical disabled figures. I was just reading today about John Goodrick, who was a disabled astronomer in a time when disabled people were normally put in a loony bin, and this guy was deaf, and yet, and although he did unfortunately die at the age of 21, he was the first person to really look and say, there is some other stuff in the universe, not just light coming in. The way he did it, he looked at the light of a star, and he saw that it fluctuated and it wasn't constant, so he realised that there was other matter out there. So
I suppose the message is that being disabled doesn't mean to say that you can't contribute to society in some
way.
Well,
absolutely.
Yeah.
That is exactly.
It's a bit of a thing. It's a bit of a morale thing, isn't it? I think if people feel that they're valued, then they're more likely to feel better about themselves and to have more to offer and to be positive about their contribution. But if they feel that they're undervalued or unvalued, then this can actually almost sort of stifle people's creativity.
Yeah. Yes. And this is the really sad thing about the work that's being done by ATOS and the Department of Work and Pensions, is that it is stifling a lot of people who otherwise could be very creative and contribute a lot to society. And the more you look at it, the more you realise that what can be done is just look. It's just looking at. It's just for disabled people to look at the way they are, and just say, I can contribute a lot, and I'm not going to let anyone take that away from me. And that might seem very hard to do, but everyone has it in them. I mean, you just look at the Paralympics and legacy. I might come on to that in a bit.
Yeah. Before you do, though, I'd like to play a little excerpt from BBC Question Time a few weeks ago, where Ian Duncan-Smith, the Work and Pensions Secretary, made an appearance. The only thing was, I was actually very cross with the BBC because they left the question to Ian Duncan-Smith about benefits right to the very end of the programme. And so let's have a listen to that now. The vehemently pro-disabled person you can hear on there is the Independent columnist Owen Jones.
We've got time for one more question. Debbie Wild.
Under the benefit cap, should large unemployed families priced out of London move to cheaper areas? Or should councils subsidise them to stay?
Under benefit cap, should large unemployed families be priced out of London, move to cheaper areas? Or should councils subsidise them to stay? Deborah Meaden.
Oh, my goodness. I was hoping I'd have a look at
Let Ian Duncan-Smith answer.
The benefit gap, rather than the housing cap, is about putting a limit to the amount of money that somebody on benefits can receive. The limit we're setting, actually, is at £35,000 a year gross, £26,000 net, which is essentially average earnings. That is a cap that says they can't earn more than that. There are some exemptions, people on disability living allowance, war widows, people who are essentially on working tax credits, they don't get. So it's those who are not working who are not in those exemptions. Does that mean that they should subsidise them? Well, there's already money to help councils to make sure they get settled in the right houses. I don't think there is any need for people to be transferred outside. There is housing inside London and the South East area that actually accommodates them. The reality is we're in touch with all the councils right now, and we're ensuring that essentially they get the money that they need to get to make sure people can be tidied over if they've got kids in school, etc. But the key point here to get absolutely right is this cap is about saying, look, when people work out there and they get to average earnings, it is quite mad that we end up paying benefits to people at way higher because they live in very expensive accommodation in different parts of London and the South East. So the cap is fairness to taxpayers as well as being fairness to benefit.
Someone who is not working and getting benefits should earn more than someone who is. I think it's quite absurd. So I think the cap is reasonable, it's appropriate.
All right, Owen Jones.
Firstly, the reason that this whole debate has become so toxic is a cynical demonisation campaign of people on benefits by this government. You can shake your head as much as you want, Ian, but what they've tried to do is redirect people's justifiable anger at the ever-declining living standards from those at the top who caused this crisis to people's neighbours down the street. The working poor against the unemployed over benefits. Non-disabled people against disabled people over benefits.
£26,000 a year.
Private sector workers against public sector workers over pensions. That housing benefit.
Earnings, average.
That housing benefit is not going into the. That housing benefit is not going into the pockets. Let me. Sorry, I'll come on to that.
No, don't. Just to answer and don't.
Housing benefit is not going into the pockets. Housing benefit is not going into the pockets of tenants. It's lining the pockets of wealthy landlords charging extortionate rents because successive governments, New Labour included, think from council housing. But I have to raise that point the audience has just raised about disabled people, because it isn't just about the cap. And if the two names...
But they're exempted.
If there's anything I want you to remember from this programme...
Disabled people are exempted
from the cap. There are two names I want you to remember.
No, disabled people are exempted from
Ryan McArdle.
No, listen, the question is...
We've got to widen this
debate. Don't go off onto some other... agenda you have. Answer the question about unemployed families. That was
the point about unemployed families. At the moment, as I've said, that housing benefit isn't going into them. It's lining the pockets of landlords because successive governments didn't
charge their rent.
But the problem is that at the moment, what you're getting is you've got working families who are losing thousands of pounds in their tax credits. That's working families at the same time as millionaires are getting a £40,000 tax cut. That is what's unfair.
Most new claimants of housing benefit are in work. They don't have enough money to pay extortionate rents. If we built housing in this country, we'd bring down the welfare bill, stimulate the economy and create jobs. But there is a point as well that has to be made about the treatment of disabled people in this country. And there are two names I just want to give Ian. And if there's anything he remembers, it's this. Brian McArdle, 57 years old, paralysed down one side, blind in one eye, he couldn't speak. He died one day after being found fit for work by ATOS. Another example, Karen Sherlock.
Hang on a second, we've heard a lot from you. Let me tell you something. I didn't hear you screaming about 2.5 million people who are parked, nobody saw them for over 10 years, not working, with no hope, no aspiration. We are changing their lives. I'm proud of doing that. Getting them off benefit is what we're going to do.
1,100 people.
All right, that's it. I'm afraid our time's up. Apologies. No, I know I can see you want to speak, but we've got to stop because our hour is up, and that is the story of Question Time. We always have to stop when things are just getting going.
That was David Dimbleby, the Oxford Bullingdon Club member, along with Boris Johnson and George Osborne and David Cameron and Nathan Rothschild, chairing that Question Time debate, which was brought to an untimely finish, Jason. he was saying there, though, that disabled people on the Disability Living Allowance are going to be exempt from this cap anyway.
As long as the Disability Living Allowance exists, because from what I've heard, they're bringing cuts to that. So, forgive me off the top of my head, I can't exactly remember the exact figures, but from what I've heard, that has been cut substantially. So, that will still mean that a lot of disabled people will still be subject to that cap. And, you know, as I said, this is the method we want to give people is things are really bad right now, but if you look at the Paralympics, I mean, it was amazing. You know, we had three Paralympians nominated for the BBC Sports Personality of the Year, and it changed a lot of people's opinion on disabled people from what actually could potentially have been a far worse situation.
But is there any kind of real legacy after the Paralympics?
We have to wait and see that. I certainly hope so. I actually personally have a friend who has been selected by Paralympics GB to go to Rio 2016. She's got sponsorship, she's got funding to do it, and I really hope that I see her in the pool in Rio. So it does remain to be seen, and I think if we can remind people of this, if we can keep it in the public domain, then I think stuff can happen. Then I think it can really make a good change, and maybe it could. Go first towards equality that any decent thinking person wants in this world.
Okay, what about what can actually be done? Have any thoughts about for the people in the sort of feeling a bit depressed who are disabled at the moment about their situation, maybe facing one of these assessments and rather worried that even though they don't feel they are able to work, that they're going to be told you are fit to work, and if you don't work, you'll have your benefits cut?
My advice to them would be to my advice for them to be to go to would be to look at a lot of the a lot of the advice groups, such as take advice offered by groups such as Black Triangle Group and other groups, stuff like that, and also just have faith. You know, there's a lot of the disability charities like Scope and National Autistic Society will help people through this. So it's not all bad, you know. There's always somebody out there for you.
Okay, so the message really being keep your pecker up, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, Jason, well, thanks ever so much for that. Now we're going to have a little chat with Jeff Sparks about Hugh Lloyd Langton. Hugh Lloyd Langton, Jeff, who was this guy?
Well, basically, Hugh Lloyd Langton was one of the original members of Hawkwind. Back in the late 60s, early 70s.
And he died recently, didn't he? Can you tell us when he died and tell us a bit, I know you've been having a look at his obituary. Tell us a bit about the guy.
Well, yeah, I mean, he was an original recording member of the psychedelic space rock band Hawkwind, and he was basically a teenager among musicians who were already music business veterans. And one of the mainstays over the past 40 years or so is Dave Brock, and the original band included also John Harrison and the saxophonist Nick Turner. You also had Dick Taylor in the band, And, oh, I mean, Langton described himself as, he described himself as overawed while recording the eponymous debut.
That was the album which had the single Hurry On Sunday, I seem to remember.
Yes.
And also, another thing I seem to remember about Hugh is that he was one of the more affable, you know, and very, very close to the public. For example, if people went along to a gig, they went to the pub next door to the venue, chances were he would be sitting in there chatting with the fans.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've heard stories from friends of mine who were big fans of Hawkwind, and yeah, they kept saying that Hugh would come along, say hello to the fans, and Hugh would class those people as friends. And whenever Hugh played either with Hawkwind or in his solo band, you know, if the fans turned up, he would say to them, right, I'll see you after the gig and we'll go off for a beer somewhere.
Well, for many of the young people today, I don't think there's really an understanding of the type of venues and music that was going on in the 1960s and 70s, which was, a lot of it was based around the Stonehenge Free Festival. And and so when I spoke to Hugh, who's now sadly passed away, in May last year, May 2011, I started really off by asking him how he first came into Hawkwind, and then I asked him all about really what it was like being a band back in the 60s and the 70s, where money was really not what it was about. It was all to do with people spending £1.50, filling up the tank of petrol and driving down to Stonehenge to play some music just to entertain people. So here now is my interview from May last year, 2011, with Hugh Lloyd Langton.
I'm Hugh Lloyd Langton, an ongoing guitarist, but occasionally get together with the Hawks even now. Well, the first encounter I had was basically with Mr. Brock, who used to... I worked in a little music shop off Oxford Street, and Dave used to come in with his pouch full of pennies after a day's busking, or before a day's busking, or evening's busking, to buy his spare strings and harmonicas, bits and pieces from this particular shop. And that's how I met Dave, and I quite often passed him while he was busking in various locations in the West End of London. You know, so we basically got to know him via my working in the shop and crossing paths quite often. I was passing him in Tottenham Court Road tube, the underpass, Tottenham Court Road. He just finished busking a number, and I just got back from a tour in Germany with the first band I was ever with. Which had basically folded up, come to a sticky end. But I just stopped to say hello, and Bucky asked me if I knew of a guitarist that might be interested in interested. I suggested, yes, I'd possibly be interested. So there you went. We had a jam, and all went fine. You know.
Now, the band was connected very much with the Stonehenge Festival. Can you give us an idea of what those early Stonehenge festivals? Now it's been replaced by this thing called Glastonbury. But what were those early festivals like?
It was always a thoroughly enjoyable time. You know, it was free for one thing. And in those days, I mean, I think practically everything Hawkwind did was a free gig or a free this or. I don't ever recall getting paid for doing anything, put it that way. I don't ever recall the weather being bad, and it was always a totally enjoyable, peaceful event, whatever, you know, which is basically why it's so sad that they put their foot down and stopped it all, because it's so, you know, but people aren't really allowed to enjoy themselves for nothing, are they?
Well, they don't seem to be any more, Hugh, no. Can you give us an idea of... I mean, it was one of those bands that certainly growing up, I was listening to them in the background, other people, I'm sure. You seemed like you were on a mission of some sort. Is that fair to say?
The mission was basically to entertain people, but that was the only mission, to entertain people and enjoy ourselves while entertaining. And it was always a little bit of a circus, the Hawkwind circumstance, as it still is to an extent, except the old Filthy Luca tends to sort of get stuck in the middle.
a lot of it was based around this kind of vision of the future, and in some people might say a bit apocalyptic. There was quite a lot of that kind of stuff in there.
There always was.
Why was that?
Well, because that is the way things are, really. I mean, everything is basically at the end of the day pointing to blinking apocalypse, isn't it? Unfortunately, it all seems to just compound itself, and nothing ever seems to have changed for the better. Doesn't seem to matter what anybody does. It just keeps on trudging on that desperate route to flipping destruction at the end of the day. You know, the bottom line, I suppose, at the end of the day, it was all peace and love, supposedly, wasn't it? But at the end of the day, it all comes down to the way human beings are. We all are, you know. I mean, nobody's immune from it all. It just seems to be sort of relentlessly heading towards that state of that horrible state of destruction, basically.
Do you think that the music that we get nowadays, that we hear on our radios nowadays, and maybe watch at Glastonbury, out on these festivals, do you see a difference in any way between what you were doing and able to do back then and what we hear now?
Well, I think the only difference is the old financial flipping differences. I mean, these days a lot of it revolves around finance. And who might be popular, and who might pull the biggest crowds, and who might make the most money. Whereas there are loads of bands that actually do Glastonbury and festivals, and they literally they do it for the same reasons, just for the love of playing and entertaining, getting out and having a good time. You know, but there are also a lot of people that won't move without a dirty great financial magnet.
What about your band that you've got now, Hugh? What kind of stuff are you up to these days?
All sorts of stuff, really. I mean, I'm doing odds and sods gigs with my own band. There's a couple of DVDs coming out that I did last year. Well, no, a DVD and a CD, and the one at Gravesend last year, and one. It was an all-day Hawkwind gig at Leamington Spa last year, which is a DVD. They're coming out soon, I think. But I just bits and pieces of my bangs. It is at the end of the day down to finance and what the old boy upstairs decrees. I've got American tour coming up. But basically playing an acoustic set with a band called Nectar, that were a 70s band, sort of a prog rock band. We're all involved with a back company called Cleopatra, who are based in America. So, I mean, God willing, that'll all happen in August, September this year.
For a lot of youngsters, we've got loads of fantastic musicians in Bristol, but as someone who's been around for a little while, and someone who's been in one of those bands that really was a head turner at the time, that had a message as well as being able to entertain and provide good music.
God willing, whoever's in the band playing is basically doing it for the love of it anyway. And at the end of the day, the love of it and the effort you put into a show, God willing, actually shines out to the audience, and so the audience will pick up on that. If it's for any sort of negative financial reason you're doing it, they might do incredibly well, but I mean, who knows? At the end of the day, it's an empty path, really.
Are there any groups you point to today? You know, sort of more popular bands in sort of top 20, there isn't really such thing anymore. But are there any bands today, or groups, or individual singers that really actually get you quite excited? Because there's so many of them nowadays. A lot of them seem to merge into each other. Are there any that stand out for you?
Yeah, I don't don't know if you've heard of a band called Anubis. I mean, I'm doing a little. Well, me and myself and Sarah, the vocalist, are putting a few tracks together. I was just told to mention that. So which will be coming out in I think it's an EP's worth at the moment.
Okay, Hugh. Finally, I just want your views on the whole free festival scene and whether you ever think that we're going to have, because there was this whole clampdown on the whole free party movement with the Criminal Justice Act back in the 1990s. Do you think there's still an appetite for that kind of thing, for free partying?
I mean, locally here in jolly old Parkstone in or Pool area, Bournemouth, Dorset, there are quite a few sort of free festivals go on. They're always incredibly well attended by a complete cross of the board bunch of people. You know, there's always going to be an appetite for free festivals, and it's as far as I'm concerned, it's a damn shame that it's all so expensive for people to get to a so-called festival. You know. It's just, I mean, it's just completely out of a lot of people's means to actually attend those things. So it's I mean, I think that there'll always be space for, or so long as they're allowed in whichever area, which is a sad thing that, you know, there's so much clamping down on anything that's free because people aren't making money out of it, basically. Councils and God knows what, you know. It's incredibly sad because, in my experience of the freebies, I mean, they were always some of the most peaceful gatherings that ever have been. You know, I don't ever recall travelling the Stonehenge thing all the while I played there. You know, which was residentially every year. You know, I think towards the end of it, that there was a small amount of trouble started happening due to small amounts of people that were causing it. But overall, they were very well attended, very well received, and loved by the majority.
Hugh Lloyd Langton there sadly died 2012, early in December. Now, Jeff Sparks, what are your thoughts having heard that conversation with Hugh?
I thought it was very, very in depth, very interesting. I mean, talking about the free festivals, talking about Stonehenge. I mean, I'll also mention that there's a key moment in Hawkwind mythology, that back in the Isle of Wight Festival in 1970, that Hawkwind, I think Pink Fairies and a few other bands, they actually set up outside the gates of the Isle of Wight Festival on the flatbed lorry and did a small free gig as a protest at the high admission prices to get into the Isle of Wight Festival in 1970. And that was also, I think that was the year that Hugh Lloyd Langton, you know, around about 70, 71, he did walk away from Hawkwind. I think he had a breakdown or something due to the drugs he was taking. But, yeah, I mean, I'm all for the free festivals.
Okay, and also, now I know when Hugh died early in December, there was some sort of little tribute to him on Radio 2, I believe, Jeff, and you heard that. But the thing is, they played a Hawkwind song, Silver Machine, and if I'm not mistaken, actually Hugh had left by the time Silver Machine actually came on, which is a bit naughty of the BBC with all the resources they've got to then play a Hawkwind song that Hugh wasn't actually performing on.
Well, the thing is, with Silver Machine, I do believe there is several versions of it around. Whether that version they played was the original or one of the, you know, reworkings that Hugh did play on, I won't know. They didn't mention it when, you know, in the intro or the outro of the song, they never mentioned, you know, whether Hugh actually performed on that.
Because I understand that commercial release was around about 1970, 71. Anyhow, when Hugh obviously had left. Anyhow, one song we do know that Hugh was on is Hurry On Sundown. I know this is one of your favourites, Jeff. Can you just tell us a little bit about this song?
Well, I don't know much about the meaning of the song. I just love the... It's just got a nice beat to it. It's just a very happy sort of song. It's...
A shame that we, I mean, I haven't heard it probably 20, 30 years on the radio. So anyway, we're going to play that now as a little tribute to Hugh Lloyd Langton. And thanks very much for discussing him with me, Jeff.
Thank you.
Well, that's a live version there of a song called Hurry On Sundown, which is sung by Hawkwind. I think it's Dave Brock actually doing the singing there. Very much a sort of local group. In fact, they're still Dave Brock and some of the Hawkwind people still definitely around. I think it's on the Dorset coast, not far from where Hugh Lloyd Langton was talking to me there before you heard Hurry On Sundown. That was a live version. Much, much cleaner version is on their first album, if you want to have a little listen to that. Anyway, we are now going to have a look at the there's a guy called Alan Frankovich, US filmmaker Alan Frankovich. He made the definitive film for Channel 4 about the Lockerbie bombing, which was never repeated, but which you can still view online. It's called the Maltese Double Cross, which suggests that there was a secret motive for the United States to blow up the Lockerbie Pan Am flight. Frankovich also directed a three-part Operation Gladio film, and that was for the BBC Time Watch series. It was shown to stunned audiences in 1992, documenting NATO blowing up European civilians and blaming it on the Russians. The Red Brigades, the Baader-Meinhof, and even the IRA, all the radicals across Europe, were being blamed for these attacks, actually carried out by NATO. Frankovich died in mysterious circumstances in Houston Airport Customs Hall in 1994. Alongside the feature films of Greek-born French filmmaker Costa Gavras, Frankovich's 70s and 80s documentaries give us a deep insight into the criminal side of Western intelligence agencies. All these secret political operations were deniable, but carried out under the secret orders of prime ministers, presidents, and royalty. Frankovich was interviewed in October 1982 by Alternative View in Austin, Texas, just after he'd released a film, In Company Business, all about the CIA. Frankovich described the CIA as a kind of Rotary Club version of the Nazis' hated secret police, the Gestapo. And this week, we look at con men, the way that the CIA was like a kind of intelligence agency, but picking up all of the ideas of the professional con man.
The CIA's been on company business for years, so what's been its job in France, Italy, Guatemala, Iran, Cuba, and the Congo? And what does Colby know, and Agee, Jackson, Braden, Nixon, Marchetti, Helms, Bundy, Stockwell, Church? And what about Truman, Ike, Kennedy? The CIA's been on company business in stealth. Now, we find out.
Well, also, a lot of the theater chains around the country are controlled by big multinational corporations that can make a political decision not to release certain films. In fact, I heard that Reds was being circulated through Texas in a cut version where some group in Dallas was marketing in this region. They cut out a lot of scenes on the grounds that the theater owners wanted a shorter movie.
Well, you see, it's difficult to say because sometimes that is true. You have to realize that theater owners, one thing motivates them, money. Mm-hmm. And for instance, if they could show on Comedy Business and make themselves rich, they'd do it. I believe me, they would. Mm-hmm. Or a film like Missing, you know. What happened there was the State Department attacked the film and it simply doubled the audiences. So in a sense, they've been using these sort of crank, right-wing crank newspapers to attack the film, or these accusations that I'm an international terrorist. Because they realized that if they started giving press conferences attacking the film, first of all, they could not sustain their argument. Because, as I said, this film is entirely told to by people who are in the CIA. And they have never found a single fact in it which cannot be defended.
Which is pretty remarkable given the amount of information that's on that film. I mean, it's a very dense, informative film, and they haven't been able to challenge anything?
No, they tried to challenge. The one thing they tried to challenge, actually, is that the CIA had funded money into the labor unions and the trucks, the trucker strike in Chile.
Right.
And they tried to challenge that on the basis that Seymour Hersh, who broke the story initially, had retracted this, but I happen to know why Seymour Hersh retracted it, and it had to do with a deal he made with somebody. But what they don't know is that I have an interview with a Chilean labor attaché, the man who actually organized the trucker strike, which is not in the film, and he confirmed that. And so, you know, I'm not a fool. I have
everything backed up.
I have everything backed up, and I'd like to get into an argument with him.
What about overseas? Have you been able to market it overseas, and what's the reception been there?
Well, overseas, it's been in 35 countries. It's been, for instance, I just was in Mexico, where the former president of Mexico, I sat with him for 3 hours. He saw the film.
What was his reaction?
His reaction was shock.
He was, who was the...
Luis Echevarria.
Yeah, according to Phil Agee, in his book on Inside the Company, he was the contact in Mexico City. Before he became president with Agee, he was the CIA.
Well, you have a situation where anybody who was a minister of interior in any Latin American country would have some contact with the CIA.
Right.
But one thing you have to realize about the CIA has different ways of using people. In other words, you can be convinced that the United States policy is fine and you want to ally yourself with the United States and not even be aware of the other levels of manipulation that they're doing with you. And they have a way of dragging you in a step at a time. In terms of Virtue Ideas Association, I know nothing about. I do know that when you see the full scope of this and the devious nature of the way they operate and how everything is done in such a way that you might be part of this operation and you won't be given the rest of the parts, that the levels of manipulation are absolutely incredible. Because you manipulate your agents, which are the locals in that country, and then if you're a CIA officer working out of diplomatic cover or business cover, you in turn can be manipulated and you will be sacrificed. You are expected, if you get caught, to be sacrificed. You will just be left behind and you're supposed to take the blame.
That's one of the reasons John Stockwell got turned off on the CIA. He became personally attached to some of the people he worked with in some of his operations and didn't like to see them get beat up or murdered or whatever once he left and the operation had collapsed.
Right. Well, there's one of the people interviewed in the film, Joseph Burkholder Smith. He describes the nature of your relationship with an agent as just, it's like being a con man working on the mark, in other words, working on your target. The only person who doesn't know what the game is your target, and you simply are, you lure him in with whatever it is. It can be blackmail, sex, money, it can be ideology. But you have a plan for him or her that they're not aware of, and you simply... And so there's dishonesty at the very basis of the relationship.
What about other countries besides Mexico? You said what?
Well, the film's in 35 to 38 countries. Mm-hmm. It's been released, or will be released in just about every European country, or it's been on television in a lot of Latin American countries and some African countries, in Australia, New Zealand. It's been at 15 to 18 film festivals.
And won some prizes?
Right. At the two prizes... At the two festivals it could compete in, it won the top prize. It could not compete in Cannes because it had been at the Berlin Festival.
Well, what about the new information about the CIA that's come out recently? Do you have any taps to what's going on? Any books that are coming out, for instance?
Well, I know of a couple of books coming out, including there's a new book coming out by someone who worked in Vietnam and Thailand. His name is Ralph McGeehee, which should be coming out in the next few months. But I think you can see, if you see on Company Business and the kind of methods the CIA has used over the past, you can see their hand in a lot of different parts of the world. For instance, I don't know, President Carter just admitted, I think in last week's Newsweek or Time, that during the hostage crisis, the United States was using media cover to get its agents into Iran. And of course, the Iranian government at that time was saying that, and none of the media were covering it. And
well, they kicked all the media out at one point on the ground, and people thought they were just being paranoid.
Yes.
But here's Carter admitting that they were justified from their point of view.
Right, and you're in the kind of situation where you find all of these things are happening, and you know some country accuses the United States of doing something, and the American media just ignores it or ridicules it. And then 5 years later, you find out that, in fact, that
they've done all that and
done
more.
All and more. Mm-hmm.
In fact, there was just a document that was leaked to the Washington Post last week, which was a, 60-some page document put together by the House of Representatives, not exactly a radical group, listing all of the CIA operations in Central America over the last few years and being quite critical of some of them. Did you get any information on that? Have you seen the booklet yet? Or?
No, I haven't seen the booklet yet, but you can see, for instance, in Central America, it has to be one of the arenas where they're extremely active. Well, they've admitted that they're channeling $19 million into covert programs against Nicaragua.
And isn't that something new where they're actually coming out and saying, okay, we're doing this?
It is new and it isn't new, you see, because you know what it really is? It's like telling somebody, look, I have this big club here, and either you do, and I'm telling you I've got this club, and either you do what I want, or I'm going to hit you over the head. And it's meant to intimidate, it's meant to frighten, it's meant to have people moderate their position. So it's not, because you have to realize that, for instance, during the CIA's program against Cuba, I must have 5 hours of material, which was filmed by the American media, including I have material which shows in 1961 Frank Sturgis training Cuban liberation fighters in the Everglades, which obviously he was working for the CIA then.
Right.
He, the CIA station in Miami arranged for them to film.
He was one of the people in Watergate.
Yes, uh-huh, one of the Watergate.
And so, possibly the Kennedy assassination.
The Kennedy assassination, right. He pops up everywhere.
Right.
That was US filmmaker Alan Frankovich speaking to the Austin, Texas VHS video news magazine, Alternative Views, way back in 1982. And we'll have more from Alan Frankovich next week. Now, Jeff Sparks and a What's On Guide. What we got this week, Jeff?
Hello, this is a What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 21st of December, Upheaval, Made to Waste, Max Harrison, Maxie Ray and Sam Whitlock will all be part of the Yuletide charity gig for the Institute of Cancer Research at the Hatchet in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door and doors open at 6pm. Into Saturday, 22nd of December, Doreen will be performing at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. On to Song of the Week, and I present Saxon. They formed in 1976 and in their career have released 19 studio albums and are still performing and releasing albums to this day. This is from the album Call to Arms, which was released in 2011, and is the song Back in 79. Saxon with Back in 79 from the album Call to Arms, which was released in 2011. They have a new album out next year titled Sacrifice, so for more information check out www.saxon747, that's the numbers 747.com. Staying with 22nd of December, Glam Harry will be performing at the Fiddlers in Railway Street, Bristol. Tickets are £8 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. Finally, on Sunday 23rd of December, From the Jam will be performing with support from the Blockheads and also Boomtown Rats at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £25 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week and a good Christmas. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. Now, for anyone listening to repeats of this for early January, are there anywhere that you'd recommend online to look for good gigs around town?
There is quite a few New Year's Eve parties going on, namely like the Fleece and the O2 Academy and the Reckless Engineer. Yeah, most of the main music venues in Bristol will have New Year's Eve parties on, so just go online, go on the websites and check them out and yeah, book your tickets as early as you can.
And we might bump into you, Jeff. You
never know.
We'll certainly be able to see you head and shoulders above everyone else.
Of course, yes.
Okay, Jeff, lovely. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast also on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Dialect's a Bristol Radio co-op production and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And as promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, 01454 318 753. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling. Wishing you a very good week, a very good Christmas, and a happy new year. Thank you for listening so much. Until the new year, goodbye.